Crazy, but I'm so happy. I've never been this happy in my life. What has happened to Janice? She has fallen in love. In her mind, David is the most wonderful man she has ever met. He is perfect in every way. He will make the ideal husband. She thinks about him night and day. The fact that David has been married twice before, has three children, and has had three jobs in the past year are trivial to Janice. She's happy, and she's convinced that she is going to be happy forever with David. She is in love. Most of us enter marriage by way of the in-love experience. We meet someone whose physical characteristics and personality traits create enough electrical shock to trigger our love alert system. The bells go off, and we set in motion the process of getting to know the person. The first step may be sharing a hamburger or steak, depending on our budget. But our real interest is not in the food. We are on a quest to discover love. Could this warm, tingly feeling I have inside be the real thing? Sometimes we lose the tingles on the first date. We find out that he spends time on crackpot websites, or she attended six colleges, and the tingles run right out of our toes. We want no more hamburgers with them. Other times, however, the tingles are stronger after the hamburger than before. We arrange for a few more together experiences, and before long, the level of intensity has increased to the point where we find ourselves saying, "I think I'm falling in love." Eventually, we are convinced that it is the real thing, and we tell the other person, hoping the feeling is reciprocal. If it isn't, things cool off a bit, or we redouble our efforts to impress and eventually win the love of our beloved. When it is reciprocal, we start talking about marriage because everyone agrees that being in love is the necessary foundation for a good marriage. The anteroom of heaven. At its peak, the in-love experience is euphoric. We are emotionally obsessed with each other. We go to sleep thinking about one another. When we rise, that person's the first thought on our minds. We long to be together. Spending time together is like playing in the anteroom of heaven. When we hold hands, it seems as if our blood flows together. We could kiss forever if we didn't have to go to school or work. Embracing sparks dreams of marriage and ecstasy. The person who is in love, we'll call her Jen, has the illusion that her beloved is perfect. Her best friend can see the flaws. It bothers her how he talks to Jen sometimes, but Jen won't listen. Her mother, noting the young man seems unable to hold a steady job, keeps her concerns to herself, but asks polite questions about Ryan's plans. Our dreams before marriage are of marital bliss. We're going to make each other supremely happy. Other couples may argue and fight, but not us. We love each other. Of course, we are totally naive. We know intellectually that we will eventually have differences, but we are certain that we will discuss those differences openly. One of us will always be willing to make concessions, and we will reach agreement. It's hard to believe anything else when you're in love. We have been led to believe that if we are really in love, it will last forever. We will always have the wonderful feelings that we have at this moment. Nothing could ever come between us. Nothing will ever overcome our love for each other. We are caught up in the beauty and charm of the other's personality. Our love is the most wonderful thing we have ever experienced. We observe that some married couples seem to have lost that feeling, but it will never happen to us. Maybe they didn't have the real thing, we reason. Unfortunately, the eternality of the in-love experience is fiction, not fact. The late psychologist, Dr. Dorothy Tenniff, conducted long-range studies on the in-love phenomenon. After studying scores of couples, she concluded that the average lifespan of a romantic obsession is 2 years. If it is a secretive love affair, it may last a little longer. Eventually, however, we all descend from the clouds and plant our feet on earth again. Our eyes are opened, and we see the warts of the other person. Her quirks are now merely annoying. He shows a capacity for hurt and anger, perhaps even harsh words and critical judgments. Those little traits that we overlooked when we were in love now become huge mountains. Reality intrudes. Welcome to the real world of marriage, where hairs are always on the sink and little white spots cover the mirror. where arguments center on which way the toilet paper comes off and whether the lid should be up or down. It is a world where shoes do not walk to the closet and drawers do not close themselves, where coats do not like hangers and socks go AWOL during laundry. In this world, a look can hurt and a word can crush. Intimate lovers can become enemies and marriage a battlefield. What happened to the in-love experience? Alas, it was but an illusion by which we were tricked into signing our names on the dotted line for better or for worse. No wonder so many have come to curse marriage and the partner whom they once loved. After all, if we were deceived, we have a right to be angry. Did we really have the real thing? I think so. The problem was faulty information. The bad information was the idea that the in-love obsession would last forever. We should have known better. A casual observation should have taught us that if people remained obsessed, we would all be in serious trouble. The shockwaves would rumble through business, industry, church, education, and the rest of society. Why? Because people who are in love lose interest in other pursuits. That is why we call it obsession. The college student who falls head over heels in love sees his grades tumbling. It is difficult to study when you are in love. Tomorrow you have a test on the War of 1812. But who cares about the War of 1812? When you're in love, everything else seems irrelevant. A man said to me, "Dr. Chapman, my job is disintegrating." "What do you mean?" I asked. "I met this girl, fell in love. I can't get a thing done. I can't keep my mind on my job. I spend my day dreaming about her." The euphoria of the in-love state gives us the illusion that we have an intimate relationship. We feel that we belong to each other. We believe we can conquer all problems. We feel altruistic toward each other. As one young man said about his fiancée, "I can't conceive of doing anything to hurt her. My only desire is to make her happy. I would do anything to make her happy." Such obsession gives us the false sense that our egocentric attitudes have been eradicated and we have become a sort of Mother Teresa, willing to give anything for the benefit of our lover. The reason we can do that so freely is that we sincerely believe our lover feels the same way towards us. We believe that she is committed to meeting our needs, that he loves us as much as we love him, and would never do anything to hurt us. That thinking is always fanciful. Not that we are insincere in what we think and feel, but we are unrealistic. We fail to reckon with the reality of human nature. By nature, we are egocentric. Our world revolves around us. None of us is totally altruistic. The euphoria of the in-love experience only gives us that illusion. Once the experience of falling in love has run its natural course, remember, the average in-love experience lasts 2 years, we will return to the world of reality and begin to assert ourselves. He will express his desires, but his desires will be different from hers. He wants sex, but she is too tired. He dreams of buying a new car, but she flatly says, "We can't afford it." She would like to visit her parents, but he says, "I don't like spending so much time with your family." Little by little, the illusion of intimacy evaporates, and the individual desires, emotions, thoughts, and behavior patterns assert themselves. They are two individuals. Their minds have not melded together, and their emotions mingled only briefly in the ocean of love. Now, the waves of reality begin to separate them. They fall out of love, and at that point, either they withdraw, separate, divorce, and set off in search of a new in-love experience, or they begin the hard work of learning to love each other without the euphoria of the in-love obsession. Some couples believe that the end of the in-love experience means that they have only two options: resign themselves to a life of misery with their spouse, or jump ship and try again. Our generation has opted for the latter, whereas an earlier generation often chose the former. Before we automatically conclude that we have made the better choice, perhaps we should examine the data. According to a substantial body of research, the divorce rate for second marriages is at least 60% and rises when children are involved. Research seems to indicate that there is a third and better alternative. We can recognize the in-love experience for what it is, a temporary emotional high, and now pursue real love with our spouse. That kind of love is emotional in nature, but not obsessional. It is a love that unites reason and emotion. It involves an act of the will and requires discipline, and it recognizes the need for personal growth. Our most basic emotional need is not to fall in love, but to be genuinely loved by another, to know a love that grows out of reason and choice, not instinct. I need to be loved by someone who chooses to love me, who sees in me something worth loving. That kind of love requires effort and discipline. It is the choice to expend energy in an effort to benefit the other person, knowing that if his or her life is enriched by your effort, you too will find a sense of satisfaction, the satisfaction of having genuinely loved another. It does not require the euphoria of the in-love experience. In fact, true love cannot begin until the in-love experience has run its course. We cannot take credit for the kind of generous things we do while under the influence of the obsession. We are pushed and carried along by an instinctual force that goes beyond our normal behavior patterns. But if, once we return to the real world of human choice, we choose to be kind and generous, that is real love. The emotional need for love must be met if we are to have emotional health. Married adults long to feel affection and love from their spouses. We feel secure when we are assured that our spouse accepts us, wants us, and is committed to our well-being. During the in-love stage, we felt all of those emotions. It was heavenly while it lasted. Our mistake was in thinking it would last forever. But that obsession was not meant to last forever. In the textbook of marriage, it is but the introduction. The heart of the book is rational, volitional love. That is, the kind of love to which the sages have always called us. It is intentional. That is good news to the married couple who have lost all of their in-love feelings. If love is a choice, then we have the capacity to love after the in-love obsession has died and they have returned to the real world. That kind of love begins with an attitude, a way of thinking. Love is the attitude which says, I am married to you, and I choose to look out for your interest. Then, the one who chooses to love will find appropriate ways to express that decision. But it seems so sterile, some may contend. Love is an attitude with appropriate behavior? Where are the shooting stars, the balloons, the deep emotions? What about the spirit of anticipation, the twinkle of the eye, the electricity of a kiss, the excitement of sex? What about the emotional security of knowing that I am number one in his or her mind? That is what this book is all about. How do we meet each other's deep emotional need to feel loved? If we can learn that and choose to do it, then the love we share will be exciting beyond anything we ever felt when we were infatuated. For many years now, I have discussed the five emotional love languages in my marriage seminars and in private counseling sessions. Thousands of couples will attest to the validity of what you are about to hear. My files are filled with letters from people whom I have never met saying, "A friend loaned me one of your lectures on love languages, and it has revolutionized our marriage. We had struggled for years trying to love each other, but our efforts had missed each other emotionally. Now that we're speaking the appropriate love languages, the emotional climate of our marriage has radically improved." When your spouse's emotional love tank is full and he feels secure in your love, the whole world looks bright and your spouse will move out to reach his highest potential in life. But when the love tank is empty and he feels used but not loved, the whole world looks dark, and he will likely never reach his potential for good in the world. In the next five chapters, I will explain the five emotional love languages, and then in chapter 9, illustrate how discovering your spouse's primary love language can make your efforts at love most productive. Your turn. Look back on that point in your marriage when reality set in and the initial romantic feelings faded. How did this affect your relationship, for better or for worse? Chapter 4. Love Language Number 1, Words of Affirmation. Mark Twain once said, I can live for 2 months on a good compliment. If we take Twain literally, 6 compliments a year would keep his emotional love tank at the operational level. Your spouse will probably need more. One way to express love emotionally is to use words that build up. Solomon, the author of the ancient Hebrew wisdom literature, wrote, "The tongue has the power of life and death." Many couples have never learned the tremendous power of verbally affirming each other. Solomon further noted, "An anxious heart weighs a man down, but a kind word cheers him up." Verbal compliments, or words of appreciation, are powerful communicators of love. They are best expressed in simple, straightforward statements of affirmation, such as, "You look sharp in that suit." "Do you ever look hot in that dress? Wow! I really like how you're always on time to pick me up at work. Thanks for getting the babysitter lined up tonight. I want you to know I don't take that for granted. I love how you are so responsible. I feel like I can count on you." What would happen to the emotional climate of a marriage if the husband and wife heard such words of affirmation regularly? Several years ago, I was sitting in my office with my door open. A lady walking down the hall said, "Have you got a minute?" "Sure, come in." She sat down and said, "Dr. Chapman, I've got a problem. I can't get my husband to paint our bedroom. I have been after him for 9 months. I've tried everything I know. I can't get him to paint the bedroom." My first thought was, "Lady, you are at the wrong place. I am not a paint contractor." But I said, "Tell me about it." She said, "Well, last Saturday was a good example. You remember how pretty it was? Do you know what my husband did all day long? He worked on updating his computer." "So what did you do?" I went in there and said, "Dan, I don't understand you. Today would have been a perfect day to paint the bedroom, and here you are working on your computer." "So, did he paint the bedroom?" I inquired. "No, it's still not painted. I don't know what to do." "Let me ask you a question," I said. "Are you opposed to computers?" "No, but I want the bedroom painted." "Are you certain that your husband knows that you want the bedroom painted?" "I know he does," she said. "I've been after him for 9 months." "Let me ask you one more question. Does your husband ever do anything good?" "Like what?" "Oh, like taking the garbage out, or getting bugs off the windshield of the car you drive, or putting gas in the car, or paying the electric bill, or hanging up his coat?" "Yes," she said, "he does some of those things." "Then I have 2 suggestions. One, don't ever mention painting the bedroom again." I repeated, "Don't ever mention it again." "I don't see how that's going to help," she said. "Look, you just told me that he knows that you want the bedroom painted. You don't have to tell him anymore. He already knows. The second suggestion I have is that the next time your husband does anything good, give him a verbal compliment. If he takes the garbage out, say, 'Dan, I want you to know that I really appreciate your taking the garbage out.' Don't say, 'About time you took the garbage out. The flies were going to carry it out for you.' If you see him paying the electric bill, put your hand on his shoulder and say, 'Dan, I really appreciate your paying the electric bill. I hear there are husbands who don't do that, and I want you to know how much I appreciate it.' Or, 'I really appreciated you taking the kids off my hands when I had to finish that project.' Every time he does something good, give him a verbal compliment." "I don't see how that's going to get the bedroom painted." "You asked for my advice," I said. "You have it. It's free." She wasn't very happy with me when she left. 3 weeks later, however, she came back to my office and said, "It worked." She had learned that verbal compliments are far greater motivators than nagging words. I'm not suggesting verbal flattery in order to get your spouse to do something you want. The object of love is not getting something you want, but doing something for the well-being of the one you love. It is a fact, however, that when we receive affirming words, we are far more likely to be motivated to reciprocate and do something our spouse desires. Encouraging words. Giving verbal compliments is only one way to express words of affirmation to your spouse. Another dialect is encouraging words. The word encourage means to inspire courage. All of us have areas in which we feel insecure. We lack courage, and that lack of courage often hinders us from accomplishing the positive things that we would like to do. The latent potential within your spouse in his or her areas of insecurity may await your encouraging words. Allison had always liked to write. Late in her college career, she took a few courses in journalism. She quickly realized that her excitement about writing exceeded her interest in history, which had been her academic major. It was too late to change majors, but after college, and especially before the first baby, she wrote several articles. She submitted one article to a magazine, but when she received a rejection slip, she never had the courage to submit another. Now that the children were older and she had more time to contemplate, Allison was again writing. Keith, Allison's husband, had paid little attention to Allison's writing in the early days of their marriage. He was busy with his own vocation and caught up in the pressure of climbing the corporate ladder. In time, however, Keith had realized that life's deepest meaning is not found in accomplishments, but in relationships. He had learned to give more attention to Allison and her interest. So it was quite natural one night for him to pick up one of Allison's articles and read it. When he finished, he went into the den where Allison was reading a book. With great enthusiasm, he said, "I hate to interrupt your reading, but I have to tell you this. I just finished reading your article on making the most of the holidays. Allison, you are an excellent writer. This stuff ought to be published. You write clearly. Your words paint pictures that I can visualize. You have a fascinating style. You've got to submit this stuff to some magazines." "Do you really think so?" Allison asked hesitantly. "I know so," Keith said. "I'm telling you, this is good." When Keith left the room, Allison did not resume her reading. With the closed book in her lap, she dreamed for 30 minutes about what Keith had said. She wondered if others would view her writing the same way he did. She remembered the rejection slip she had received years before, but she reasoned that she was a different person now. Her writing was better. She had had more experiences. Before she left the chair to get a drink of water, Allison had made a decision. She would submit her articles to some magazines. She would see if they could be published. Keith's encouraging words were spoken many years ago. Allison has had numerous articles published since then, and now has a book contract. She's an excellent writer, but it took the encouraging words from her husband to inspire her to take the first step in the arduous process of getting an article published. Perhaps your spouse has untapped potential in one or more areas of life. That potential may be awaiting your encouraging words. Perhaps she needs to enroll in a course to develop that potential. Maybe he needs to meet some people who have succeeded in that area, who can give him insight on the next step he needs to take. Your words may give your spouse the courage necessary to take the first step. Please note that I am not talking about pressuring your spouse to do something that you want. I'm talking about encouraging him to develop an interest that he already has. For example, a wife might pressure her husband to look for a more lucrative job. The wife thinks she's encouraging her spouse, but to him, it sounds more like condemnation. But if he has the desire and motivation to seek a better position, her words will bolster his resolve. Until he has that desire, her words will come across as judgmental and guilt-inducing. They express not love, but rejection. If, however, he says, "You know, I've been thinking about starting a handyman business on the side," then she has the opportunity to give words of encouragement. Encouraging words would sound like this: "If you decide to do that, I can tell you one thing. You will be a success. That's one of the things I like about you. When you set your mind to do something, you do it. If that's what you want to do, I will certainly do everything I can to help you." Such words may give him the courage to start drawing up a list of potential clients. Encouragement requires empathy and seeing the world from your spouse's perspective. We must first learn what is important to our spouse. Only then can we give encouragement. With verbal encouragement, we are trying to communicate, "I know, I care, I am with you, how can I help?" We are trying to show that we believe in him and his abilities. We are giving credit and praise. Most of us have more potential than we will ever develop. What holds us back is often a lack of courage. A loving spouse can supply that all-important catalyst. Of course, encouraging words may be difficult for you to speak. It may not be your primary love language. It may take great effort for you to learn this second language. That will be especially true if you have a pattern of critical or condemning words, but I can assure you that it will be worth the effort. Kind words. Love is kind. If then we are to communicate love verbally, we must use kind words. That has to do with the way we speak. The same sentence can have two different meanings, depending on how you say it. The statement, "I love you," when said with kindness and tenderness, can be a genuine expression of love. But what about, "I love you"? The question mark changes the whole meaning of those three words. Sometimes our words say one thing, but our tone of voice says another. We are sending double messages. Our spouse will usually interpret our message based on our tone of voice, not the words we use. "I would be delighted to wash the dishes tonight," said in a snarling tone, will not be received as an expression of love. On the other hand, we can share hurt, pain, and even anger in a kind manner, and that will be an expression of love. "I felt disappointed and hurt that you didn't offer to help me this evening." Said in an honest, kind manner can be an expression of love. The person speaking wants to be known by her spouse. She is taking steps to build intimacy by sharing her feelings. She is asking for an opportunity to discuss a hurt in order to find healing. The same words expressed with a loud, harsh voice will not be an expression of love, but an expression of condemnation and judgment. The manner in which we speak is exceedingly important. An ancient sage once said, "A soft answer turns away anger." When your spouse is angry and upset and lashing out with words of heat, if you choose to be loving, you will not reciprocate with additional heat, but with a soft voice. You will receive what he is saying as information about his emotional feelings. You will let him tell you of his hurt, anger, and perception of events. You will seek to put yourself in his shoes and see the event through his eyes, and then express softly and kindly your understanding of why he feels that way. If you have wronged him, you will be willing to confess the wrong and ask forgiveness. If your motivation is different from what he is reading, you will be able to explain your motivation kindly. You will seek understanding and reconciliation, and not to prove your own perception as the only logical way to interpret what has happened. That is mature love. Love to which we aspire if we seek a growing marriage. Love doesn't keep a score of wrongs. Love doesn't bring up past failures. None of us is perfect. In marriage, we do not always do the best or the right thing. We have sometimes done and said hurtful things to our spouses. We cannot erase the past. We can only confess it and agree that it was wrong. We can ask for forgiveness and try to act differently in the future. Having confessed my failure and asked forgiveness, I can do nothing more to mitigate the hurt it may have caused my spouse. When I have been wronged by my spouse, and she has painfully confessed it and requested forgiveness, I have the option of justice or forgiveness. If I choose justice and seek to pay her back or make her pay for her wrongdoing, I am making myself the judge and she the felon. Intimacy becomes impossible. If, however, I choose to forgive, intimacy can be restored. Forgiveness is the way of love. I am amazed at how many individuals mess up every new day with yesterday. They insist on bringing into today the failures of yesterday, and in so doing, they pollute a potentially wonderful day. "I can't believe you did it. I don't think I'll ever forget it. You can't possibly know how much you hurt me. I don't know how you can sit there so smugly after you treated me that way. You ought to be crawling on your knees, begging me for forgiveness. I don't know if I can ever forgive you." Those are not the words of love, but of bitterness and resentment and revenge. The best thing we can do with the failures of the past is to let them be history. Yes, it happened. Certainly it hurt, and it may still hurt. But he has acknowledged his failure and asked your forgiveness. We cannot erase the past, but we can accept it as history. We can choose to live today free from the failures of yesterday. Forgiveness is not a feeling, it is a commitment. It is a choice to show mercy, not to hold the offense up against the offender. Forgiveness is an expression of love. "I love you, I care about you, and I choose to forgive you. Even though my feelings of hurt may linger, I will not allow what has happened to come between us. I hope that we can learn from this experience. You are not a failure because you have failed. You are my spouse, and together we will go on from here." Those are the words of affirmation expressed in the dialect of kind words. Humble words. Love makes requests, not demands. When I demand something from my spouse, I become a parent and she the child. It is the parent who tells the 3-year-old what he ought to do, and in fact, what he must do. That is necessary because the 3-year-old does not yet know how to navigate in the treacherous waters of life. In marriage, however, we are equal adult partners. We are not perfect, to be sure, but we are adults and we are partners. If we are to develop an intimate relationship, we need to know each other's desires. If we wish to love each other, we need to know what the other person wants. The way we express those desires, however, is all important. If they come across as demands, we have erased the possibility of intimacy and will drive our spouse away. If, however, we make our needs and desires known in the form of a request, we are giving guidance, not ultimatums. The husband who says, "Could you make that good pasta one of these nights?" is giving his wife guidance on how to love him and thus build intimacy. On the other hand, the husband who says, "Can't we ever have a decent meal around here?" is being adolescent in making a demand, and his wife is likely to fire back, "Okay, you cook." The wife who says, "Do you think it would be possible for you to clean the gutters this weekend?" is expressing love by making a request. But the wife who says, "If you don't get those gutters cleaned out soon, they're going to fall off the house. They already have trees growing out of them," has ceased to love and has become a domineering spouse. When you make a request of your spouse, you are affirming his or her worth and abilities. You are in essence indicating that she has something or can do something that is meaningful and worthwhile to you. When, however, you make demands, you have become not a lover, but a tyrant. Your spouse will feel not affirmed, but belittled. A request introduces the element of choice. Your mate may choose to respond to your request or to deny it, because love is always a choice. That's what makes it meaningful. To know that my spouse loves me enough to respond to one of my requests communicates emotionally that she cares about me, respects me, admires me, and wants to do something to please me. We cannot get emotional love by way of demand. My spouse may in fact comply with my demands, but it is not an expression of love. It's an act of fear or guilt or some other emotion, but not love. Thus, a request creates the possibility for an expression of love, whereas a demand suffocates that possibility. More ways to affirm. Words of affirmation is one of the 5 basic love languages. Within that language, however, there are many dialects. We have discussed a few already, and there are many more. Entire volumes and numerous articles have been written on these dialects. All of the dialects have in common the use of words to affirm one's spouse. Psychologist William James said that possibly the deepest human need is the need to feel appreciated. Words of affirmation will meet that need in many individuals. If you are not a man or woman of words, if it is not your primary love language, but you think it may be the love language of your spouse, let me suggest that you keep a notebook entitled Words of Affirmation. When you read an article or book on love, record the words of affirmation you find. When you hear a lecture on love or you overhear a friend saying something positive about another person, write it down. In time, you will collect quite a list of words to use in communicating love to your spouse. You may also want to try giving indirect words of affirmation. That is, saying positive things about your spouse when he or she is not present. Eventually, someone will tell your spouse and you will get full credit for love. Tell your wife's mother how great your wife is. When her mother tells her what you said, it will be amplified and you will get even more credit. Also, affirm your spouse in front of others when he or she is present. When you are given public honor for an accomplishment, be sure to share the credit with your spouse. You may also try your hand at writing words of affirmation. Written words have the benefit of being read over and over again. I learned an important lesson about words of affirmation and love languages years ago in Little Rock, Arkansas. My visit with Bill and Betty Joe was on a beautiful spring day. They lived in a cluster home with white picket fence, green grass, and spring flowers in full bloom. It was idyllic. Once inside, however, I discovered that the idealism ended. Their marriage was in shambles. 12 years and 2 children after the wedding day, they wondered why they had married in the first place. They seemed to disagree on everything. The only thing they really agreed on was that they both loved the children. As the story unfolded, my observation was that Bill was a workaholic who had little time left over for Betty Jo. Betty Jo worked part-time, mainly to get out of the house. Their method of coping was withdrawal. They tried to put distance between each other so that their conflicts would not seem so large. But the gauge on both love tanks read empty. They told me that they had been going for marriage counseling but didn't seem to be making much progress. They were attending my marriage seminar, and I was leaving town the next day. This would likely be my only encounter with Bill and Betty Jo. I decided to put everything on the table. I spent an hour with each of them separately. I listened intently to both stories. I discovered that in spite of the emptiness of their relationship and their many disagreements, they appreciated certain things about each other. Bill acknowledged, "She's a good mother. She also is a good housekeeper and an excellent cook when she chooses to cook." But, he continued, "there's simply no affection coming from her. I work my tail off, and there's simply no appreciation." In my conversation with Betty Jo, she agreed that Bill was an excellent provider. "But," she complained, "he does nothing around the house to help me, and he never has time for me. What's the use of having the house, the recreational vehicle, and all the other things, if you don't ever get to enjoy them together?" With that information, I decided to focus my advice by making only one suggestion to each of them. I told Bill and Betty Jo separately that each one held the key to changing the emotional climate of the marriage. "That key," I said, "is to express verbal appreciation for the things you like about the other person, and for the moment, suspending your complaints about the things you don't like." We reviewed the positive comments they had already made about each other, and I helped each of them write a list of those positive traits. Bill's list focused on Betty Jo's activities as a mother, housekeeper, and cook. Betty Jo's list focused on Bill's hard work and financial provision for the family. We made the list as specific as possible. Betty Jo's list looked like this. "He hasn't missed a day of work in 12 years. He is aggressive in his work. He has received several promotions through the years. He's always thinking of ways to improve his productivity. He makes the house payment each month. He's a good financial manager. He bought us a recreational vehicle 3 years ago. He keeps up with the yard work or hires someone to do it. He is generous with finances. He takes the garbage out once a month. He agrees that I can use the money from my part-time job any way I desire." Bill's list looked like this. "She makes the beds every day. She keeps our house clean and orderly. She gets the kids off to school every morning with a good breakfast. She cooks dinner about 3 days a week. She buys the groceries. She helps the children with their homework. She transports the children to school and church activities. She teaches first grade Sunday school. She takes my clothes to the cleaners." I suggested that they add to the list things they noticed in the weeks ahead. I also suggested that twice a week they select one positive trait and express verbal appreciation for it to the spouse. I gave one further guideline. I told Betty Jo that if Bill happened to give her a compliment, she was not to give him a compliment at the same time, but rather she should simply receive it and say, "Thank you for saying that." I told Bill the same thing. I encouraged them to do that every week for 2 months, and if they found it helpful, they could continue. If the experiment did not help the emotional climate of the marriage, then they could write it off as another failed attempt. The next day, I got on the plane and returned home. I made a note to call Bill and Betty Jo 2 months later to see what had happened. When I called them in midsummer, I asked to speak to each of them individually. I was amazed to find that Bill's attitude had taken a giant step forward. He had guessed that I had given Betty Jo the same advice I'd given him. But that was all right. He loved it. She was expressing appreciation for his hard work and his provision for the family. "She has actually made me feel like a man again. We've got a ways to go, Dr. Chapman, but I really believe we're on the road." When I talked to Betty Jo, however, I found that she had only taken a baby step forward. She said, "It has improved some, Dr. Chapman, Bill is giving me verbal compliments, as you suggested, and I guess he's sincere. But he's still not spending any time with me. He's still so busy at work that we never have time together. As I listened to Betty Jo, I knew that I had made a significant discovery. The love language of one person is not necessarily the love language of another. It was obvious that Bill's primary love language was words of affirmation. He was a hard worker, and he enjoyed his work, but what he wanted most from his wife was expressions of appreciation for his work. That pattern was probably set in childhood, and the need for verbal affirmation was no less important to his adult life. Betty Jo, on the other hand, was emotionally crying out for something else. That brings us to love language number two. Your turn. Share instances with your spouse when words had a profound impact on your life, positively or negatively. If your spouse's love language is words of affirmation, I want to give you some suggestions. Number one, to remind yourself that words of affirmation is your spouse's primary love language, print the following on a 3x5 card and put it on a mirror or other place where you will see it daily. Words are important. Words